Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Our first case this morning is West Bend Mutual Insurance Company against Belmont State Corporation. Mr. Piper.
Thank you. May it please the court, my name is William Piper. I represent West Bend Mutual Insurance Company, the appellant. West Bend seeks to enforce a judgment against the assets of the judgment debtor, Belmont State, which were paid to Banco Popular and applied by the bank to the debt of Mark Gazinski without any evidence of the bank having obtained authority to do so. Gazinski, who was also found liable to West Bend for fraudulent procurement of bonds, was the sole signer of the Belmont bank account at U.S. Bank. After contract funds from the bonded projects were deposited into the account, Gazinski signed and delivered several Belmont checks payable to Banco Popular. The bank at that point could either accept the checks or reject the checks. It accepted them, and instead of holding the checks and the funds for Belmont, applied the funds collected on the checks to Gazinski's mortgage debt owed to the bank. The rule applicable to this case, which gives rise to the bank's liability, was clearly summarized by this court, and that is where a check is drawn payable to the order of a bank, is presented to such a bank, and the drawer owes no debt to the bank, has no account at the bank, the bank must see that the proceeds are not misapplied and cannot, without justification, divert the proceeds to the use of one other than the drawer, and is authorized to pay the proceeds only to the person specified by the drawer. The bank takes a risk in treating the check as being payable to the bearer and is placed on inquiry as to the authority of the drawer's agent to receive payment. Now, those are not my words in support of West Bend's position, but those are the words of this court. And there are two distinct duties that emanate from that rule. The first duty, which gives rise to liability, is that when the bank received the funds, acted as the collection agent to collect the funds through the banking system, it had a duty to hold the funds. That's a duty implied in law, which the courts recognize as an implied contractual duty of a depository bank. But flowing from...
You mean a depository bank?
Pardon?
You mean a depository bank?
Depository bank, yes.
Depository bank.
Depository bank.
That's what Article 3 of the UCC calls it. There's no such thing as a depository bank under the UCC.
Okay. But the case law says the presumption is that the bank will hold the funds for the depositor. Flowing
so
from
what,
that,
what evidence
the bank
did West,
will hold the ahead. Funds for the drawer.
The drawer.
Not the depositor.
Well, in this case, the facts show that the drawer was Belmont State.
Exactly. Well, I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. I just wanted to know what evidence did West Bend offer that proves that Banco would have discovered that the checks were not authorized had it fulfilled its duty of inquiry? Specific evidence, not sort of generalizations which you made reference to.
Well, there's two duties. There's two forms of authorization. One is, were the checks authorized? The fact of the matter is, Gazinski was a signer on the account. So the check was authorized in that sense, and there's no dispute about that. In terms of, was Gazinski authorized to deposit the funds into his mortgage account, the evidence shows that when we took his deposition during the citation proceedings, he testified initially that he was only authorized to pay the debts of Belmont State. And Belmont State didn't owe the bank any money. Belmont State only had certain obligations to Gazinski. And when you take a look at the total evidence, all of the checks, which the court was aware of from our motion and through the testimony, Gazinski had a lease where he was due $3,200 a month, but received $44,000 in checks payable directly to him, another $128,000 that were paid to the bank. There was another $58,000 that went to another company he had a connection with, which was MJG, in which the court granted us a judgment against under a money hadn't received theory. His tax return said he only earned $14,000 in wages that year, and he fully accounted for all of the rent. So when you take a look at the total amount of payments he had received, that evidence suggests that he received far more than what he was entitled to, and in fact was taking money. And when I asked him why he didn't report all of this income on his tax return, you know, his flippant answer was, that's Uncle Sam's problem, not his.
So your position is that Banco should have discovered all this information.
What I'm saying is that the duty to inquire does not establish liability, but it establishes the bank's lack of good faith.
Who is Belmont's chief financial officer?
I don't know that anyone had that particular title.
Well,
The only one that had
the bank had an obligation to inquire of Belmont. That inquiry would have been made of some live person. Who would that have been?
Well, the record, and according to Mr. Gazinski's testimony, the owner of the company, the president of the company, was Jan Gadd.
All right. So do we have the deposition of that person? That person who
he could
have
not
told
be found.
Us?
He could not be found.
Well, isn't that something of a problem? I mean, what happened in this case is the district court held that you, as the plaintiff, have the burden of persuasion on this issue to show what Belmont would have said had it been contacted. Now,
and in that regard, the issue is who has the burden of proof. And the Illinois case law clearly establishes that once a deposit has been proven, and that was established, there's no question, the burden is on the bank to prove its authority to dispose of the funds in the manner it did.
We could overrule Travelers Casualty against Wells Fargo?
Travelers
said the opposite.
Travelers does not apply to the facts of this case.
Why not? Because doesn't this ring more in tort law rather than the UCC?
Travelers was decided under Section 406, I believe, of the UCC because in Travelers, Wells Fargo was a drawee bank. It was the bank upon whom the checks were drawn. And under the UCC, there's no obligation upon a drawee bank to call up its drawer and ask every time, did you authorize this check? The issue in Travelers was that there was an unauthorized or forged check. The party who signed the check was not authorized. And that's entirely different from our case. So in an action between a drawer and the drawee bank, because of the presumption that a check it receives is authorized, the UCC imposes a burden upon the drawer to notify the bank and prove that the check was not authorized. In Mutual Services, which said that the action was actually a contract action, they said that the UCC did not apply to the obligations of the payee bank, that was an entirely different scenario, and therefore, I'm not asking the court to overrule Travelers. I'm asking the court to find...
Is there any particular language in Article 3 of the UCC about this issue?
I believe I cited to Section 406, which is the same Section 401 and Section 406 of Article 3 of the UCC, which is cited in the brief, and Mutual Services specifically addresses the issue that the UCC did not apply to the duty of the bank to hold the funds.
So, but you would agree, wouldn't you, under the Fiduciary Obligations Act, Westfin would have the burden of proving actual knowledge? I mean, the whole point of that act is to limit the liability of banks and to try to make that kind of showing has to be made. Doesn't Westfin bear that burden?
What Section 5 does is, and this is what the Maryland Casualty case states, is that it excuses a lesser degree of knowledge on the part of the bank. And it basically, the cases say it follows the common law that when a payee bank receives a check payable to it from someone and it's asked by a third party to apply the check to another account or to a debt that third party has to the bank, the bank is put on notice. It's put on notice that it can't just blindly accept that check and do what it's told to do by someone who is not the drawer on that check, who doesn't own that check. The liability of the bank here is established by the implied contract that the law in Illinois establishes upon the bank, that when it received the funds, it has a legal obligation to hold those funds from the drawer. The whole issue of the duty to inquire really goes to the defense of the bank. Did the bank act in good faith? And that obligation, the so-called negligence that we hear about.
I don't understand where imputed states of mind get us. Banks don't have minds. Only people have minds. The rule here is that the bank, the depository bank, has to put the funds to the purpose for which the drawer tells it to. And what we have here is Gazinski, who was authorized to draw checks for Belmont, tells it to put it to a particular use. And we don't apparently have any evidence that had a different person in Belmont been contacted, the bank would have told it to put it to a different use. Why isn't that the end?
Well, it's not the end because the law in Illinois says authority of Gazinski cannot be presumed. Here you have Gazinski acting in his own self-interest, and Gazinski is self-dealing.
Gazinski may well be a thief, as well as a tax cheat. But if the rule is that the funds are supposed to be put to the use specified by the drawer of the checks, and Gazinski actually has authority to sign checks on behalf of Belmont, which he does, and Gazinski says put it to use X, then it seems you would need some contrary evidence, you know, evidence that had the president, CEO, been contacted, the CEO would have said, don't do that. But there doesn't appear to be any such evidence. That comes back to my question, what more does one need?
Well, but the presumption is the other way, because the duty to inquire presumes when Gazinski directs the application of payment, he doesn't have the authority. And I believe, with due respect, there is a logical leap that one makes when you go from the authority to write check to all of a sudden assuming that person, if he's acting as an agent for Belmont in signing the checks, can now use the funds for his own self-interest. And that is a certain a leap in logic that the law does not recognize. And, in fact, the law states that the presumption is that Gazinski does not have the authority to engage in self-dealing. So there is actually two issues there that the court needs to address. In quick summation, you know, the Travelers case does not apply simply because that's an action between a drawee and the drawer. Mutual service is you know, directly on point, and the whole string of case authority in Illinois places the burden upon the bank to prove authority. And I don't think Travelers overrules that line of Illinois cases.
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Mr. Piper. Ms. Baran.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm honored to be here. My name is Geraldine Baran, and assisting me is Jackie Vangel, who wrote the briefs. I'm here, and I will start with the arguments that the court has already addressed questions on relative to whether the district court properly denied West Bend's motion for the constructive trust. The court determined that while there was evidence that Banco had a duty to inquire and that Banco failed in its duty to inquire of Belmont, that there was no evidence essentially of causation that somehow Belmont was damaged as a result of Banco's failure to inquire. So essentially this case comes down to a question of failure of proof. I don't think it really matters, frankly, whether we are pursuing this case under the traveler's tort liability or whether we are looking at this case under a implied contract under the mutual services line, because under both, you would have to establish causation. And in both circumstances, it was not done. I believe that the court, district court selected the traveler's case because it was, in fact, more on point. Banco did not have a banking relationship with Belmont. And in not having that relationship, it looked more like the Schwab situation with Schwab and Alliance. Without that type of relationship, there was a theory of liability that was available to Belmont, West Bend, in this supplementary proceeding where it could pursue the case under tort liability. And so that's one area in which the court could have gone. But the circumstances here are that West Bend, acting as Belmont, did not present any evidence that, for instance, that Kaczynski was a fiduciary. There was no evidence presented there that Belmont was actually a fiduciary, just that Belmont signed the check. That there was no evidence presented that Kaczynski was, in fact, self-dealing. There was no evidence that he was not authorized by Belmont to write the check, and there was no evidence presented that Belmont ever objected to the payment of the checks. What West Bend is trying to argue is presumption. Well,
according to Mr. Piper, Belmont's CEO is on the lam. How does one tell whether Belmont objected? Belmont is obviously an irresponsible corporation. It incurred a debt, and it's trying to duck out. Kaczynski is essentially trying to steal what's left of its money for his own benefit. I mean, this doesn't sound like a situation in which anyone should assume the bona fides of anybody at Belmont.
I think it's important that the court recognize how this case came here, in the sense that this was a supplementary proceeding. Belmont, what West Bend did is it got a judgment against Belmont, and then it looked back through all of Belmont's records and said, aha, maybe I have a cause of action here against Banco. Maybe there is a pocket I can look to fill this debt, because Belmont, Belmont's checks are improperly.
I suppose you're the wrong person to ask. Maybe I should have asked Mr. Piper. Maybe Mr. Piper will tell us on rebuttal. Why wasn't Belmont dropped into bankruptcy? The trustee in bankruptcy could have avoided this payment to Banco Popular on behalf of Kaczynski as avoidable preference, because that's what it was. It was a payment in preference to somebody who had a higher claim to the money. And these kinds of things are routinely avoided in bankruptcy.
I think it might have been due to the timing of the payments. These checks were actually written by Kaczynski on Belmont's account in 2007 and 2008. You know, so in that very early time period, these series of checks equating to about $129,000 were written by Kaczynski. And there was no objection by Belmont at any time during that time period to, and no evidence presented that Belmont had ever objected to the payment of these checks.
Of course, Belmont didn't object, right? Belmont at this point is a shell. It owes much more money to West Bend than it has.
Not then it didn't. The judgment actually against Belmont, the default judgment, was not until, I believe, 2009. So really, at this time, Belmont is still a functioning entity. And at that time, Belmont didn't object to the use of these checks. So, you know, in that sense, I think when the court is considering this issue and considering the, you know, who has the burden of proof here, I think the court will find that Travelers got it right in the circumstances based upon the nature of who Banco was to Belmont, and that we should follow that line of cases and find that this is a duty of inquiry under the common law tort theory as opposed to any other theory. Although I do think the end result would be the same. But in terms of looking at it, I think that's the situation. I know we raised in our brief whether or not if the elements had been established, whether or not the Mormon doctrine would apply. But frankly, without the elements, we don't need to go there. With that, unless there are further questions for me on West Bend's appeal, I'd like to move, because it's a cross appeal, I'd like to move to Bonko's appeal. In Bonko's appeal, we're appealing a different couple orders that were entered by Judge St. Eve. Those orders were entered at basically in a different time period. Bonko was ordered to turn over to West Bend monies that it had received under the citation to turn over monies that Bonko had received as rent payments in the January through July 2010 time period. So this is after the judgment's been entered against Belmont and Gazinski. During that time period, a citation was served both on Gazinski and on Bonko, and I'm assuming on a number of others. Bonko received rent payments from Gazinski. They were cash payments that it received from Gazinski. Under the articulation made by Judge Posner in this court in the Bloomfield case, we believe that rent doesn't change its character to become personal property once it's recovered. And as between two competing lien holders, a judgment lien holder and Bonko, which had an assignment of rent lien, between these two competing lien holders, neither of which is in possession of the property, we believe that the court got it right the first time when she decided that Bonko was entitled to the money that it received.
But in Bloomfield, the court appointed a receiver to collect rents for the bank after the IRS filed a tax lien. Why isn't that distinguishable then from our situation?
I think that's an interesting point on the case, but I don't really think that was the reason why this court, under Judge Posner writing the decision, decided that the rent didn't change character. The court wasn't focusing on who had the rent. The court was focusing on the nature of the rent, and it was basically saying that the rent was derived from property on which there was a lien, and wasn't looking at whether or not one person or the other had a receiver. It's interesting to note here that neither party was in possession. All West Bend had in this circumstance was a citation. It was not in possession of the property. So, you know, in that sense, it's not more like the bank in the Bloomfield case than we are. Both of the lien holders did not have possession of the property. And so what we're saying to the court is don't let a judgment lien holder who has a lien that's subordinate, that's junior to the lien of the bank, step in, because if that's the case, then there's really no reason for a bank to ever take an assignment of rents, because a judgment creditor could simply come in and take those rents away. So what we're saying is that the court got it wrong when it bought into the argument presented on reconsideration motion, the fourth or fifth one in this case, that the property somehow transformed from being an interest in real property to becoming personal property, which would have been subject then to the citation lien. And I do think it's a very interesting question. There really are no cases directly on point to this issue. The Stevens case, which was decided by the Illinois Supreme Court, does provide a scenario where there is a judgment creditor and a mortgagee, similar to what we have here. But in that circumstance, the judgment creditor in that situation had a receiver appointed, so that judgment creditor was actually in possession of the property. So what we're looking at here is a circumstance where we have these two competing lien holders, neither in possession, and so therefore the court should look at the hierarchy of the liens and give Bonko the higher priority, because its lien was actually recorded in 2004, well before the citations.
Let me ask you this question. How do you respond to the argument that the sanction imposed against Bonko was appropriate because it violated the citation prohibition on the transfer of assets, regardless of whether the district court initially held that Banco had a superior lien?
I think that the way to look at that is to look again at the nature of the rent payments. There's been no controversy between the parties that these were, in fact, rent payments. And so based on that, as rent payments, as an interest in real property, they never became personal property, which would have then put Banco in violation of the prohibition against transfer if it had received personal property that belonged to Gazinski. It never had personal property belonging to Gazinski in its possession when it held on to those those cash rent payments. So I think the distinction is we didn't violate the prohibition of transfer because we never had the type of property that would have been subject to that citation lien. And that would be the answer I have to that circumstance. I could go to my conclusion. Basically, you know, what we're asking the court to do is to reverse the district court's decision to require Banco to turn over the $62,000 in cash payments and the order that we pay these fees to West Bank. We're again asking the court to recognize that Banco had the superior perfected lien and that the collected rents did not become personal property but remained an interest in real property as articulated, we believe, by the Bloomfield case, and that Banco did not violate the prohibition of transfers. And as between these two creditors, neither of which are in possession, we believe Banco had the superior lien. So unless there are further questions, I thank you very much for your attention.
Do you want to speak to the attorney's fees issue a little bit more?
Certainly, yes.
Yeah. Do you think this issue is so clear below that it justified the award of attorney's fees and costs?
I don't think that it was so clear below, but I don't think that it was appropriate for the – first off, you know, we did talk about the issue of costs in our briefs. What the court could order would cost, not attorney's fees. And so our argument would be that you couldn't order attorney's fees under the statute. But that all being said, what costs are awarded to a judgment creditor who has to spend extra effort or time to get these assets to which they're entitled. And we believe that these assets were assets to which they were not entitled. And so they're being awarded for chasing an asset to which they weren't entitled. And since it was not personal property, we shouldn't be punished for not freezing what wasn't even the property. Now, I can understand that the court, in looking at this, was probably like, why didn't you come to us? Why didn't you come to the court and say to us, you know, what should we do with this rent payment that we received? You know, certainly that would have been best practices to do that, but I don't think that we should have been sanctioned for not doing that, particularly where that property is not property subject to the citation.
Thank you.
And again, thank you so much for your time. Mm-hmm. Again, it's definitely an honor to be here.
Anything further, Mr. Piper?
Yes. First, in responding to the cross appeal, the Bloomfield case doesn't apply because there a trustee was appointed by the bank, or excuse me, a receiver appointed for the purpose of collecting the rent. The assignment of rent relates back to the time of the mortgage and the recording, but the receiver is authorized because the receiver is in possession to collect the rent, and in that case it was the receiver that actually rented the property. Wheaton Oaks, this court decided that the bank cannot enforce the assignment of rents until it takes possession. That's the law in Illinois. And in Comerica, where you had a competition between the mortgagor and two mortgagees, and you had a bank trying to enforce the assignment of rents before it took possession, the court ruled that the first mortgagee was not entitled to keep the rent. The second mortgagee suffered from the same defect because it was not in possession, and it ordered that the money go back to the mortgagor. And that's because once the mortgagor collects the rent, it's his. He doesn't have to account to the mortgagee for it. It becomes personal property. And once it becomes personal property, it's not real property. An assignment of rents is a real property lien and doesn't extend to personal property. Only the UCC applies to a personal property lien. And so the district court was correct in ruling that the bank had no lien on any cash, regardless of the source, in the hands of Gazinski, which he used to make his mortgage payments. And by the bank taking and receiving the money and then applying it to the mortgage, they violated the prohibition against transfer. And the only lien that existed on those funds was the citation lien, and both the bank and Gazinski were subject to that citation lien. With regards to the court's point, why wasn't Belmont thrown in bankruptcy? There are issues of timing, and there are issues as to which creditors would benefit from it. But the most important thing is that, you know, West Bend decided to obtain a judgment and then enforce it against assets which it could discover because it has a lien. Your Honor pointed out, you know, one cannot assume the bona fides of Belmont, nor can one assume the authority of Gazinski. And if you take a look at the Deland case, which is an Illinois Supreme Court case, there the Illinois Supreme Court reversed because of a jury instruction that was given that said if the jury instruction says, you know, the plaintiff has a burden of proof, and if the evidence is even, you have to rule on the side of the defendant, the bank. And the bank said, no, the court in giving that jury instruction was wrong because all that they had to prove was the deposit, and that it became the burden of the bank once the deposit was established to prove the authority to apply it to some debt. And so if you take a look at the Deland case, which I think directly responds to the court's questioning, is why should we question Gazinski's authority? And that's because he has no authority to apply it to his own personal debt. And the bank should have known that. When they saw a check coming from Belmont, somebody should have picked up the phone. If they want to claim some sort of defense based upon their good faith investigation that they talked to somebody at Belmont that said, yes, go ahead and apply it, you know, that may have been an issue, but the court found it breached that duty because it conducted no inquiry. And it should have known, the cases in Illinois clearly state, it should have known from the face of the check that the funds belong to Belmont. The law is, as a depositor, Belmont was entitled to the funds. There was a debt that the bank owed to Belmont when it collected on the checks. What it did with the funds, it has to prove its own authority. And the bank has never answered the question where it got the authority to apply it to a third party's debt that was owed to the bank. In that regard, I ask that the court reverse the district court and award us the $128,000 that was deposited with the bank, and affirm the district court with respect to its order of turning over the $62,000 that Gazinski wrongfully transferred to the bank. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. The case is taken under advisement.